This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know that old camp song about making new friends but keeping the old? One is silver and the other is gold. Well, those friends are getting awfully expensive these days. Gold's hitting record highs, and heaven help you if any of your friends are covered in petroleum. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. He's in Dubai reporting for our broadcast from the Middle East next week. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the third day of March. So when is bad news good news? You may know the answer if you've invested lately in gold, oil, or a lot of other commodities. The sinking U.S. dollar is causing many investors to move their money into assets with a reputation for being safe havens. For the fourth straight trading day, gold prices hit a record, $989 an ounce. Silver is at highs not seen in 27 years. And then there's black gold. Some crude oil prices hit $104 a barrel today. We asked senior business correspondent Bob Moon to explain what is driving the commodities craze.
In some cases, it's a rush to stock up on raw materials before the cost goes even higher. With gold and oil, though, investors are simply climbing on for the ride. Ron Goodis is a trader at Equitex Brokerage Group. He says the value of those commodities is directly tied to the greenback.
Because gold and oil are priced in dollars, the price naturally has to go up in order for the producers of oil and gold to be compensated for the lesser value of the dollar that they're receiving.
Bullion traders are downright giddy over gold's prospects precisely because the dollar sank to its lowest value in 35 years today against six other major currencies. The Fed is signaling more interest rate cutting ahead, and Goodis says it'll be no big deal for gold to hit the $1,000 mark soon.
I don't think necessarily that the round number will mean anything. I just think potentially we're going to blast right through the 1,000, and that's going to become a new floor. And, you know, maybe we head up to 1,200 or 1,300 over the next few months.
He's quick to caution the markets are on pins and needles, so investors need to stay on pins and needles, too. Analyst Stephen Schork says that also applies to oil prices. From Vienna, where OPEC is meeting, he warns that oil speculators could soon see market realities burst their bubble.
OPEC is adding spare capacity. The United States is probably in a recession, so you're going to see a material pullback in demand. Rising supply, falling demand ultimately should lead to a pop in this balloon.
Both market watchers say for the immediate future, though, they see prices heading higher. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A daring cross-border raid. The leader of a terrorist organization is taken out. Sound like the Middle East? Try South America. Over the weekend, Colombia sent troops into neighboring Ecuador and killed a top leader of the FARC, a rebel group. Ecuador and its ally Venezuela responded by sending troops to the border with Colombia. What's preventing these South American nations from going to war? Here's Marketplace's Dan Gretsch.
In Venezuela, the suggestion of a war with neighboring Colombia has come as a shock.
It's about as inconceivable that we go to war with Colombia as the United States going to war with Canada.
That's Venezuela's Robert Botom, publisher of Veneconomia, a leading financial journal. He says the economies of Venezuela and Colombia are too intertwined for the countries to go to war.
Colombia is our second largest trading partner. Well, I guess the way to put it is, would it hurt us? Yes, it would hurt us.
Venezuela faces food shortages right now because of government-imposed price controls. That's made it more dependent on Colombian meat, milk, and produce. Last year, Colombian exports to Venezuela increased 87% to $4.5 billion. Reardon Rowett is with Johns Hopkins University.
We have a new Chavez bourgeoisie that spends and consumes, and Colombian goods are of high quality and are in demand in Venezuela.
Michael Shifter is with the Inter-American Dialogue. He says despite Venezuela's oil wealth, Chavez can't afford to go to war.
Chavez, above all, wants to keep his power, wants to increase his power, and this would tend to undermine him because he would lose the tremendous trading relationship that he has with Colombia.
Chavez's ally Ecuador also has troops at Colombia's border. Outsiders are trying to broker a peace between the three nations. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Shares in EADS, the parent company of Europe's Airbus, surged today. It was the first trading day following the Pentagon's surprise announcement that it's giving a $35 billion airborne tanker contract to a partnership of EADS and Northrop Grumman. The announcement was a huge blow to Boeing. John Dimsdale reports the decision to give such a massive military contract to a foreign company has sparked a backlash in Washington.
Norman Dix is a Washington State Democrat, also known as the congressman from Boeing. He was at the Boeing plant Friday evening, ready to celebrate the Pentagon's announcement. He got quite a shock, and today he's still angry.
I also think it is wrong to outsource a contract of this magnitude to the Europeans. They would never do it for us when we're in a recession, when we need everything we can possibly get to spur the economy ahead. And then we're going to give this thing away. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Dix, who's on the House Appropriations Committee, is hoping Congress will freeze the spending for the tanker contract and make the Air Force start the bidding over. But defense analyst Lauren Thompson at the Lexington Institute says the Pentagon has proof the EADS deal is better.
The reality here is that Boeing lost on the merits, and fairly decisively.
But Democrats point out that Republican presidential contender Senator John McCain opposed giving the tanker contract to Boeing 5 years ago, saying it would be too costly. Richard Abulafia is an aircraft industry analyst with the Teal Group.
Eventually, you could find that the Democratic players involved use that as a rationale to politicize this contract and try to move against the contract because it's all gone to mostly Republican industrial districts.
After all, he says, while Boeing would have built their planes in Democratic districts in Washington and Connecticut, Northrop and EADS will be creating jobs in Alabama and North Carolina. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, those commodities prices we mentioned kept things from going too far south. Details when we do the numbers. $5 here, $2.50 there. Pretty soon it adds up to real money that you are paying banks for them to hold your cash. By law, they're required to disclose the fees that they charge for checking and savings accounts. But a new report from the Government Accountability Office finds that many banks make it difficult for consumers to uncover those fees. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
GAO employees posed as consumers. They visited 185 banks trying to get information about checking and savings account fees. 20% of the time, they failed. That doesn't surprise Bob Sullivan, author of Gotcha Capitalism.
It was impossible even for government investigators to find out what these hidden fees would be, which means for the average consumer trying to pick a checking account at a bank, they have no tools to decide what the best account is because all of these fees are really hidden.
Some banks charge for overdrafts, others charge for paying bills by phone.
There's even fees in some banks for walking in and talking to a teller.
On average, fees now account for 27% of a bank's revenue, or more. Again, Bob Sullivan.
There are individual smaller banks that have revealed that they make about half of their profits from fees.
But Nessa Fettis with the American Bankers Association says most banks are good about disclosures. She faults the GAO employees for talking to tellers instead of speaking with the appropriate person, the new accounts manager.
The new account representative is usually someplace else, and you do have to make sure you get to them just as if you're going grocery shopping. You don't go to the produce section if you have questions about the fish.
Fettis says the responsibility rests with consumers.
The fees are avoidable. Accounts are basically available for free. Consumers don't have to pay anything.
They may not have to, but they do. In 2006, Americans paid over $36 billion in bank fees. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
29 middle school students in New Jersey escaped detention today. Their offense? They protested shorter lunch periods by paying for their snacks all in pennies. The penny has gotten a lot of attention recently. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says if he had his way, he'd do away with the 1 cent altogether. Now, another hallmark of U.S. currency is under the microscope. A new $5 bill makes its debut next week. Yet another effort to crack down on funny money. Here to talk about the new Lincoln is Professor Stephen Mim of the University of Georgia. He literally wrote the book on counterfeiters. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's get down to a brass tacks or paper tax, I suppose.
Right.
What is this new five going to look like?
Well, it's going to look a lot like the old five in the sense that you still got the big head of Lincoln. You know, all these notes that have come out in the last decade.
Really big head.
Really big head. And actually, this one is even a little more prominent because unlike the old version, this one no longer has a border keeping the head separate from the rest of the bill. So kind of Lincoln's head kind of rises up in the middle of the bill. And then when you flip it over, you actually, the most prominent thing you see, and designedly so, is a gigantic purple five on the lower right-hand corner.
Purple?
And this purple.
This sounds like the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
It is. It's definitely one of the most colorful bills we've seen yet, and one of the farthest from the kind of humble look of the greenback a decade ago. This five is actually both meant to deter counterfeiters and to help people who have visual impairments.
So once a new bill is in circulation, how long does it generally take for counterfeiters to catch up?
Very quickly, and I think that's a testament to a lot of the availability of digital technologies, and increasingly counterfeiting is becoming a very high-tech profession, whether it's practiced by criminal gangs in Bulgaria, Colombian drug cartels, or, if the evidence can be believed, North Korea. And, you know, so there are much more powerful tools at the disposal of people committing fraud than there ever were, say, in the 1930s or the 1950s.
How do we consumers know which ones are real when there are so many changes that come about year after year? In fact, I remember pulling out a $10 bill from my wallet just a couple of weeks ago, looking at it and thinking, that doesn't look right, but it felt right. And I thought, well, they change these things all the time, so I guess it's okay.
That's a really good point. I think there's a potential danger here that we're changing the currency so often now that we're not really becoming habituated to what an ordinary bill looks like. And the fact is, it's an overlapping process. So right now, you have many different versions of a $5 bill that are about to be put into circulation or become in circulation. So this could become an issue along the way where people, as you say, kind of look at this and think, well, is that right? Really?
Is this a bit of an historic moment? Lincoln was the one who presided over the creation of the greenback, and now his face is on the most modern incarnation of that.
That's right. It's, you know, the greenback first surfaced in 1861 in the middle of the Civil War to pay for the cost of the war. And it's kind of appropriate that we're kind of coming around full circle. Of course, this new bill is coming out at precisely the moment when the dollar seems to be losing some of its standing in the international market. And there may be a kind of closing of the circle, perhaps, where the dollar may just end up becoming another one of these currencies that countries issue, as opposed to something truly international and dominant.
Well, Stephen Mim, thanks for all the talk of the fiver today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, dealing with life and death in Saudi Arabia.
Do you have to look at the actual body?
Yeah, I had to see whether the passport photo is matching or...
You have to check and see if the photo matches the body.
But first, let's do the numbers. Reports of rising oil prices and weak construction pushed stocks down on Wall Street today. The Dow ended down less than a tenth of a percent, just 7 points, to close at 12,258. The Nasdaq nudged down half a percent, 12 points, to end at 2258. The S&P basically traded flat, finishing at 1331. Investors cashed out of financials as analysts cut several profit forecasts. Both Citigroup and Goldman Sachs lost more than 2.5%. Lehman Brothers lost more than 4.5%. Google swirled down 3% after an analyst predicted lower earnings estimates for 2008. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.55%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide, online at clevelandclinic.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the School Nutrition Association continues its legislative action conference. Coinciding with the conference is a House committee hearing on improving nutrition and food safety in the nation's schools. And it's National Grammar Day. You can do your part by speaking and writing well and place your commas correctly. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in Dubai. Former Hollinger International CEO Conrad Black took a one-way trip from his Palm Beach estate to a federal slammer in Orlando today. It's the start of a 6.5-year sentence for fraud. Black, of course, is just the latest corporate figurehead to go to jail. Today we have the final segment of management guru Charles Handy's commentary series, in which he hopes U.S. corporations again become forces of economic good.
This week, my short stay at the Drucker School in Claremont, California, comes to an end. And I must say goodbye to America for the time being, as I return to London. I leave with high hopes that a new mood of optimism is being born here, that America will in time regain the moral high ground. It will once again be the city on a hill for the rest of the world to admire. I have one plea. Could you please do what is necessary to restore our faith in the corporations of business, a faith that has been so damaged in recent years? The tall towers that house our corporations are the new palaces of our day, the places where real power resides. But those towers are full of paradoxes, made of glass you can't see inside. They're pillars of our democracy, but they are run as totalitarian states. Their names are reduced to a set of initials. Their leaders are unknown to those outside. They are accountable, for the most part, to other institutions that sit in similarly anonymous towers. To the average person, they are foreign entities shrouded in mystery. It is no wonder that we look at them with suspicion, touched with envy. Tales of bloated executive pay, of backdated stock options and mountain and severance payments, these things only reinforce the feeling that the corporations and those that run them are more concerned for themselves than for those they are there to serve. Capitalism and democracy are uneasy bedfellows. If capitalism does not obviously serve society, the people will vent their anger. Governments will then be forced to put hoops and hurdles around the organizations of business, crippling and frustrating them. That does no one any good. Please open the windows of those towers. Let us see that you are working for us, not yourselves, that fairness and honesty are there to stay, that you still deserve our trust, because you matter.
Charles Handy is a visiting scholar at the Drucker School of Management and the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. His latest book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Time now for Working, our monthly look into the life of a single worker in the global economy. Over the next 2 weeks, the Marketplace programs are broadcasting from the Middle East. Next week, this program will be in Dubai. Workers from outside the region power much of the Gulf economy. About a quarter of the people living in Saudi Arabia come from somewhere else. All foreign workers have the same rights in Saudi Arabia, at least when they're alive. But if a non-Muslim dies in that country, and thousands do each year, they're sent home for burial. From Jeddah, Kelly McEvers introduces us to one of the workers responsible for the last long goodbye.
Not long ago, an Egyptian security guard working here in western Saudi Arabia had a heart attack and died. Pretty soon, his life was reduced to a pile of papers. In a small beige office full of old-school typewriters at the back of a shipping warehouse.
Medical report, police report, death certificate.
A pile of papers stacked on the desk of Wahid Khan Habibullah.
And exit paper, we have exit paper and his passport copy.
It's taken 8 days for Mr. Khan to assemble the Egyptian's documents. Now, it's time to check the body.
Do you have to look at the actual body?
Yeah, I had to see whether passport photo is matching or...
You have to check and see if the photo matches the body.
Khan is a foreign worker too, from Bangalore in southern India. He first came to Saudi Arabia in 1997 to perform Hajj, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. Back then, Khan stayed with his cousin. He liked being close to Mecca so much, his cousin got him a job at a shipping company. At first, Khan handled regular cargo, food and clothes and furniture that wealthy Saudis would ship to their villas on the Riviera. Then, in 2003, a guy at his office left and handed Khan his portfolio. Dead bodies. Now he divides his time between the shipping office and here, the morgue. The drill for Khan is the same every time. Workers carry the body out of the morgue and into a dusty courtyard full of stretchers made of what look like old wooden doors. Khan views the body.
Is this your guy?
Yeah, he's our guy.
Okay, so you have to check now the picture?
Yes.
Look, yeah,
this
wow.
Is
okay.
Lifts the body into the coffin and drags the coffin to the van. Writes the name of the deceased on the coffin with a Sharpie. Locks the coffin. Loads the coffin. And drives to the airport.
This is your job.
Yeah, this is our job. We have to do it.
I think it's very sad.
That is what, when we are coming, when we are mourning, the people will be happy. We got a baby boy, a baby girl, or this. When we die, we will close this chapter.
The first time you did you feel some emotion the first time?
Yes. When I handle the first dead body, that is the accident.
A car crash. Khan says the victim was so badly mangled, his eyes were upstairs in his forehead.
And I did not sleep for the 3 days and the nights. Whenever I sleep, I'm thinking about him, how he happened, why he happened, or why he drive this so fast.
Khan says he still thinks about his cases, but they don't haunt him anymore.
After 3 days, I got one more dead body to handle. And I became a little bit strong. This is the life we have to do.
These days, Khan handles 10 to 12 cases per month. That's a lot, but it's nothing compared to his main competitor, Muhammad Salim from Pakistan. He's been processing human remains here in Jeddah for 15 years.
Yeah, I'm the famous one in Jeddah. You know?
Salim recently reached a personal record, 60 foreign workers dead in just 1 month.
India,
Lahore,
Pakistan, Bangladesh. This is too going to Manila, I think.
One quarter of Salim's cases are accidents, on the job, on the road. The other three quarters die of natural causes, mostly heart attacks.
To Yemen.
Human rights advocates told me they suspect many foreigners die here because they're subjected to harsh working conditions. But Salim says it's because they eat too much fat, too much chicken skin.
The taste is in the skin. Inside, there's no taste.
Han disagrees. He says workers die from stress, from being so far away from wives and kids and parents. Han doesn't have that stress anymore.
And that is dining hall.
His wife, Sadia, got a visa to come here and teach Hindi and Islamic studies. The Hans live in a two-bedroom flat with their three-year-old daughter, Nabiha. The walls are bare, except for Nabiha's English lessons and framed religious passages.
Yeah, that is also part of the Quran.
In the hallway are the 99 names of God, embossed in golden Arabic. Han takes me to the sitting room, where his wife can't hear us. Sadia doesn't know her husband handles dead bodies for a living. If she knew, he says, she'd worry too much about his mental health. Besides, in their culture, men don't talk about work with women.
When I feel anything, when I'm sad, she knows about me.
But she doesn't know why you're sad.
She will ask many questions, but I will ignore for everything.
Han makes about $800 a month. He says he doesn't want to get rich handling dead bodies, to work on commission, like his rival, Salim. Instead, Han just hopes someone will do the same for him when he dies.
By God's grace, anything happens to me, so somebody will help me, as for how I am helping to others.
A couple hours later, Han heads to the airport to check a body that's going out on a midnight flight. He passes through security, signs some papers, and watches as the body rolls through a screening machine on a conveyor belt made of steel wheels.
I will think about him. What is the future of his family? When he was there, he's earning money to get happy with the family and everything. Now, after him, what they will do?
Back at home, Han washes his hands and face, kneels down on a small carpet, and, as he does after every case, asks God to give good things to the dead man's family, wherever they might be.
Our profile was produced by Kelly McEvers in collaboration with Homelands.org. For a slideshow and reporter's notebook, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, in tough economic times, you can fantasize that the chief executives of the world feel our pain. Coca-Cola's outgoing chief is feeling flush instead. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that Neville Isdell raked in $21.7 million last year, including stock options and bonuses. Isdell is planning to step down from the top job on July 1st. It appears the company is rewarding him for fizzy returns. The beverage company's revenue climbed 20% last year. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 7 points, less than a tenth of a percent. The Nasdaq fell 12 points, half a percent. And the S&P 500 basically traded flat. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, an old gambling hub places bets on future popularity.
Atlantic City is evolving and growing, not despite the fact that it's lost its monopoly, because it's lost its monopoly.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.